already there were rumblings in the army and in the forces in general, both Indian troops who are recruited to the army because it's a traditional method of sending cash back to the village. If I can take the Sikhs, I mentioned the Gurkhas, but I'll leave the Gurkhas to one side. We've just had on television the Queen has been in Nepal, and we know that Gurkhas, by tradition, sent money back to the village. That was their link with the British Army, but they had a special... But Sikhs, Rajputs, Marathas, had a tradition of some member of the family being in the army at any given point in time and sending money back. It was a source of income to the family, the extended family. And I got on extremely well with these people. But Congress and the independence movement was beginning to infect, affect our troops.
And you mean your Indian troops?
The Indian troops. And we did get news of mutinies in the Navy and different sectors. Our own troops by that time, my own friends and myself, having had nearly 4 years in India, and we listened very carefully to the news, mainly from the Russian front. We could tell by March of 45 that the Russians were advancing in strength and the Germans were retreating, and the German war was nearly over. We took more interest in the Russian front than we did in any other front. And there was a general feeling in the British army members attached to the Indian division that I was in, that it was about time we were sent home and we were relieved. And when we heard that we could go home, I think we more or less lay on our charpoys.
A go slow moment?
More or less. That we weren't interested very much more in the war. True, the war in the East hadn't finished, but we felt that once the war in Europe was finished, resources could deal with the Japanese. The resources released. We knew that in Burma the Japanese lines of communication were very much extended. It was only because we were weak that they were able to retain their position.
So the restlessness in the army, as far as the British troops were concerned, was really to do with their desire to get the thing over with and go back to Civvy Street,
yeah.
Was it?
To get back to England. In particular. I mean, true, they wanted to be in Civvy Street, but they'd had enough of being overseas. 4 years is quite a time, although some of the regular soldiers who went home first should have been, say, demobbed in 1939. And because of the war, were kept on. So they had, some of them had had 7 years in India. And
was this tendency to go slow, as it were, obvious to your superior officers, to the NCOs?
Well, we were NCOs.
Well, to your superiors?
Well, yes, but... Again, this is just a personal view, and probably it was shared by a number of people who thought about it. We didn't have a great deal of respect for officers in the British Army. We had respect for the few who were good technicians. But signals is carried by the NCOs and the other ranks. And the few good technicians are usually ex-post office personnel or ex-Indian telegraph personnel or people with a degree in physics who've been commissioned.
But what I'm getting at is, was it not obvious to the officers that you are not putting yourselves out?
Oh, yes, but we had, as I say, there's only a few key officers we had contact with. The British Army seems to carry a surplus of officers who are unnecessary. Or, to us, they're unnecessary. Maybe they're for discipline purposes, but...
Didn't the officers try to put their foot down about it?
No. Many of them probably thought the same as we did. Conscripts. And it became clear, I think, when we got back to England. I got back to England on April the 1st, 1945. And when was the general election, the 45 election?
I'm not sure. I think it was round about then.
It was just later, a little later. The war, when after VE Day, it was decided to have an election. And I was in Catterick on a course in the School of Signals. In fact, when I was back in Newmarket, where we were in England, I was stationed in Newmarket, I was sent on three courses in my English Army career after the experience of Burma. And one of the courses was at the School of Signals, Catterick, and the election was on. And we just took vehicles and motored up into the Dales from Catterick, Richmond, the Dales, would sit in a pub, take in a set and tune in to the election results or what was going on. And if we had an officer, junior officer, a lieutenant with us, he wouldn't say a thing, because he'd be as interested as we were. And I think the effect of the war and the vote for the Attlee government, the vote for the Labour Party, which produced the Attlee government, infected the junior ranks of the officer corps as much as it did the other ranks.
Did you ever come across forces parliaments at this time?
No, we were in the blue. Forces parliaments were in places like Cairo, Delhi, Calcutta, Rangoon, all the big centres. So it was the people who had base jobs. And base jobs give you plenty of time.
Coming back to this left-wing feeling in the army at the time of the 1945 election, what seemed to cause it in your view? Do you think it was the way in which the war was handled, or the way in which the war had come about, or what?
Well, partly the conscripts' experience of the war and the relations with officers. If I can give the two colonels I worked with. The colonel who saw that I didn't go beyond the corporal, the 14th Indian Divisional Colonel of Signals, was an Irishman, had been an All India athlete, ranker, and had risen from the ranks because of his athletic prowess. Don't think for his intelligence, and I've got nothing against Irishmen, highly intelligent Irishmen. But he had the regular soldier mentality. Now, the other colonel of the division that relieved us, I got on extraordinarily well with. I hardly exchanged words with this colonel, the Irish colonel, because he was too busy at a mess, which was the mess where the general fed and the people who were key people for him fed. B mess was where the medics and the ordnance and that sort of officer fed. But the other colonel was hunting, fishing and shooting. I used to read his papers that came through the signals office, the Tatler, the Sphere, all the glossy magazines that a cavalry, because he was he'd been in signals in the cavalry days when they were mounted on the northwest frontier. And the public school manner and the country gentry manner is much easier to get on with than the regular soldier. I mean the regular from the ranks, the ranker regular soldier who haven't the either the graces or the common sense to handle people. So I think it's out of these experiences that people made their attitudes. And then one has so much time in the company of people over and gossip when you're not on duty. And there's nothing else to do. Some of my friends played chess for 4 years. Others played bridge for 4 years. I can say I talked for 4 years.
But these type of factors which you've isolated, such as contact with the regular army and so on, were present in the First World War when you didn't have a left-wing influence in the election after the First World War.
That is true, but the First World War just produced, I would say, it wasn't the Russian Revolution that produced the Communist Party in Britain. The First World War was just as much a factor. Just as much a factor. And in my part of the country, from my father, you see, he was in the 8th DLI, Durham Light Infantry. The colonel of the 8th DLI was the agent for the Peel & Main Colliery Company. So the class positions were quite clear then. And in my part of the country, there wasn't any. You didn't have to win anybody to the Labour Party. The war won already. There'd been won since the Labour Party was formed. But for Southerners, for Londoners, perhaps they had. It is much easier to live in your own ghetto in London and be ignorant, even though the West End exists and the Savoy exists. It's much easier to be ignorant of classes other than your own, unless you happen to go to Cambridge and Oxford as a working class.
You were talking about officer rankers just now, as compared with those who'd come from public schools.
Yeah.
Was there any difference between the two types of officers in respect of fairness in how they dealt with the other ranks?
I think the public school has the edge on the ranker because they don't. Many of the rankers just haven't had this social experience. They've gone into the army as young people. They haven't had the experience of either organising football clubs or political parties or trade unions or any of the what we will call the civil society apparatus. Their whole experience was conditioned by army life and they hadn't even absorbed the concept that the main function of an officer is to look after their men.
How would that show itself?
Well, just by their relations to their men. They still were thinking as private or rankers. They weren't thinking as officers. Their mentality had been conditioned by their experience in the ranks and not. It was just a wartime expedient that they happened to be officers.
Was there any feeling that they would be exploiting their position for their own benefit?
Well, it varied, but a lot of them, I would say, my own section officer in particular, saw it as a means of saving more money. He was a Yorkshireman, and he was careful, and he'd rather drink my tea in the other rank's canteen and talk to us in that sense, but it wasn't at a high level. It was just humdrum matters. And then spend his time in the officer's mess where he felt a bit out of it and where he had to spend a lot of money on drink. In fact, I was better off as a corporal than probably a sergeant or a junior officer who had access to beer and whiskey and so forth. I didn't. Not that I wanted it. But I saved my money on it as a corporal's pay. So I'm sure some of the regular soldiers could save a bit more than me out of their captain's pay.
But was this attitude which you've just outlined about the difference between officers who had risen from the ranks and those who had not, was that attitude shared by other men? By your comrades?
Well, maybe other men would not think about it as clearly as I did, because I had... Again, I didn't have an anti-militarist outlook in one sense, but in another sense I did. And because of my position politically in London, I would be able to mix with people like John Cornford, Maurice Cornforth, products of James Klugman, products of Cambridge in the 30s. I would meet, in my position as a bookseller, I would meet Wheeler Bennett, who was at the Royal Institute of International Affairs. I'd meet members of Parliament from all parties who would come into the shop for political literature. I don't know if you know of Mountbatten's method of having umpteen aides. Well, I knew intimately one of his aides, called Captain Peter Murphy. This is pre-war. Captain Peter Murphy was his expert on communism and briefed Mountbatten. So I had a great respect for my enemy by knowing that they're the intelligent sectors of my enemy.
Why did Mountbatten require an expert on communism?
Well, because he was a student enough to know that this was a force in society.
And what was this Peter Murphy like?
Oh, he was a very... Well, he was... I've read some reminiscences about Peter Murphy, but there was a Mountbatten broadcast. But Peter Murphy, well, to me, he was a public school, Cambridge, upper class type. But apparently he wasn't terribly rich, and I thought he was. But he was very easy to get on with, and he would talk to me about all sorts of aspects of politics. This is when I was in King Street, or in earlier, when we had a bookshop in Farringdon Road, in the Left Book Club days.
So he would just come into the bookshop to get literature?
To get the latest literature and to be briefed by me on what was worth reading and what, you know, what... I mean, he had free choice, of course, but he was astute enough to use me as well as Mountbatten used him.
Did he explain his relationship?
Oh, no.
Mountbatten to you?
I learned about this later because he set up a bookshop in West London called Peter's Bookshop. And his batman had been a communist, or his chauffeur batman, or his valet. I don't know, it may have been a civilian when he was in Civvy Street.
But when you met Peter Murphy, what did you understand his interest to be? Just as an ordinary member of the public?
Or? No, I understood he was a friend of Mountbatten's.
So he talked about Mountbatten to you?
Not much, but I gathered that he was interested in communism, and I think he was genuinely interested in communist ideas. Murphy. And Murphy had... I have here, it was sent to me by a friend of mine, because I was discussing Murphy and Mountbatten to a journalist, and he was very interested, and I gave him information such as I'm giving you now, and he sent me a brief from a BBC report on Mountbatten, dealing with Peter Murphy. But at that time, Peter Murphy didn't talk explicitly about Mountbatten, but I knew that it had come up that he was friendly with Mountbatten. But during the war, I learned later that he was recalled to the army and he was at Kandy with Mountbatten.
How many times?
Oh, about once a week, once a month at the least. And he would buy Communist Party literature and other Marxist literature.
So how many times would you have met him in total?
Probably a few score times, I don't know.
Did you meet him socially, or was it just...
Oh, no, only in the bookshop.
Coming back to something you said earlier about India, you said that the Indian troops were being influenced by Congress. What evidence did you have for that?
Well, I saw from time to time somebody being carted away by military police or by NCOs, and they were shouting Congress slogans. So it may have been that it might have been a way of getting out of the army for some. But on the other hand, I think there was, late 1944 and early 1945, it was fairly obvious that Congress was, and the Quit India movement was going to come out on top. And I think this is why Jinnah was given such a free hand.
What slogans were they shouting, though?
Was it Jai Hind? I was not up in all the Congress slogans, but...
Were there people you knew?
People in my... Not in signals, but in the infantry companies around me. But again, you must remember, they went on... Being in India, they would go on leave regularly to their villages. So they would be infected by Congress thinking.
But did you know these individuals personally?
No, no.
So it wasn't your influence?
No, no, no.
How many people did you see affected in that way?
Oh, probably only two or three immediately. But, I mean, for two or three in my immediate experience would reflect probably thousands.
What were they, Sikhs or what?
Probably one would be Sikh, but in the main I think they were Marathas.